This morning we have two cases on our 9 o'clock docket. The second case, Bridges versus Alcon, has filed a motion for continuance for submission, so that motion has been granted. So we will hear Hussein Abdul-Wahab versus Sams, and then we will go directly to Baylor All Saints versus Martin. All right, if the clerk will announce counsel for the first case. Thank you. Ms. Bartlett.
Yes, sir.
Do I wait for this to come on or just...
When the green light
is
on.
May it please the court, good morning. We're here today on an appeal of the trial court's judgment granting the appellee's motion to dismiss and releasing claims and parties beyond those that were released in the parties' mediated settlement agreement. We're also here on the subsequent denial of timely requested findings of fact and conclusions of law and a timely filed motion to modify, reform, or correct judgment. The trial court in this case abused its discretion by disregarding the express terms of the party's mediated settlement agreement, which was on file with the court, and rendering a judgment that released and discharged claims against parties that the court had notice were not agreed to by the appellant.
Exhibit 4, right?
I believe so.
It's the shortest mediated settlement agreement I've ever seen.
I agree. I believe it's one sentence. The meat of it is actually one sentence.
Okay. Well, lesson learned.
Alternatively, the court abused its discretion by rendering a judgment enforcing the party's agreement without notice, pleadings, or proof as required in a breach of contract or enforcement claim, which is the pretty well-settled law in Texas that is the procedure for enforcing a mediated settlement or a Rule 11 agreement, is by a separate breach of contract or an enforcement claim. In Davis v. Wickman, the court stated that a trial court may enter a judgment on a mediated settlement agreement where one of the parties contests his intent to be bound only by one of the procedural methods set forth in the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure, namely summary judgment or trial. Put another way, the final judgment was essentially one of two things. It was either an improper consent judgment purportedly rendered on the settlement agreement of the parties when the court had noticed that the appellant did not consent to the terms at the time it was rendered, or it was a judgment enforcing the party's mediated settlement agreement without notice, pleadings, or proof. It's also possible that the trial court may have viewed the appellee's contention in its motion that appellant's trial lawyer had initially approved certain formal settlement documents and that the appellant allegedly later refused to sign that formal document. It may have constituted a withdrawal of consent. But because the trial court didn't issue the findings of fact and conclusions of law, the appellant really doesn't have any way of knowing exactly why the trial court ruled the way it did, and that was harmful error as well. In its briefing, the appellee doesn't appear to know for sure why the trial court ruled the way it did either, because on the one hand, Sams contends that the judgment was rendered on the mediated settlement agreement, and that the trial court was not on notice that the appellant had withdrawn his consent to that agreement. And this actually points to a faulty premise that the appellee basically starts from in every argument that it makes, is that the appellant, Abdul-Wahab, claims to have withdrawn consent to the mediated agreement. And to be clear, the appellant never withdrew his consent to the mediated settlement agreement. But the express language of that agreement only released claims that could have been brought in the lawsuit between the named parties. The appellant never consented to the release of any claims against non-parties and never signed any document releasing those claims, including the purported proposed formal agreement. If the judgment had actually been rendered on the mediated settlement agreement, it would have either referenced that agreement or it would have incorporated its terms, rendering a judgment in strict and literal compliance with the party's filed agreement. The court really needs only compare the mediated settlement agreement itself, which, as you mentioned, is very short, and compare that with the trial's judgment that it actually rendered to see that the judgment went beyond the scope of the agreement and released additional claims and parties that were not released in the mediated settlement agreement. And the court actually looked no further than Appellee's motion to dismiss to see that the trial court was on notice that the appellant didn't consent to the terms that were set forth in the motion. The motion contains at least one, or I think, believe two, judicial admissions that the appellant had refused to sign the formal settlement documents because he was considering a lawsuit against a real estate broker, a claim that Sams, the appellee, argued he had agreed to release. The motion also included a certificate of conference, and that certificate of conference certified that the parties were not in agreement regarding the subject matter of the motion. So the trial court was fully aware, or at least on notice, that the motion to dismiss was opposed and that the appellant was not in agreement with a dismissal under the terms of the motion to dismiss. The appellee also argues that its motion met the notice and pleading requirements of a breach of contract or enforcement claim, and the appellate disagrees, first because the case was set to be dismissed by submission of a motion to dismiss as opposed to being set for an evidentiary hearing. And second, because the motion didn't have a clear allegation of any material breach of the terms of the settlement agreement. The only allegation in the motion was that the appellant had refused to sign formal settlement documents that his counsel had allegedly initially approved.
Wasn't there a hearing on the motion to dismiss?
It was by submission only. There was no hearing.
Okay. And did the appellant ever ask for a hearing, an evidentiary hearing?
No, it did not. The appellant was believed that the law was clear that when faced with a filed mediated settlement agreement that the court had the discretion to do one thing, and that was to enter judgment in compliance with that agreement. So it didn't appear
tell
that
me again how the court was on notice that you disagreed that the proposed judgment didn't conform to the terms of the settlement agreement?
Well, first of all, the settlement agreement had been filed on two separate occasions leading up to the motion. It was attached to the motion. And then in the body of the motion, the appellee clearly states that the appellant did not agree to release potential agents and specifically real estate brokers.
But that motion isn't one of these attachments.
The motion, what, the attachments
motion
to the... The motion to dismiss is in the record that, okay, and referenced in the appellant's motion. If you're asking whether I attached it to the appellant's brief, no, I did not. But the motion itself does state that, in at least in Appellee's opinion, the appellant did not agree to the terms, the extended terms, which had to do with potential agents and real estate brokers. The language of the mediated agreement itself simply said claims between the parties. It did not extend to these. And, I mean, the nature...
Part of the problem is that that language is actually subject to different interpretation because you interpret it to mean between the parties, but actually the real estate broker could have been brought into the litigation, and between the parties could be a term that describes just the litigation itself. I mean, it's subject to different interpretations, is it not?
That certainly may be true, which is why the notice and pleading requirement on a breach of that such an agreement is so important. That there needed to be a pleading that this had been breached for a specific reason and proof of that breach. There was no proof submitted of any breach of this agreement. Whether there were disputed terms, I mean, that's really the point. There were disputed terms in this agreement, clearly, and it shouldn't have been just everything dismissed based on a motion to dismiss. There should have been a full evidentiary hearing based on pleading and notice of the intention to do that. And the problem with mediated settlement agreements is that the parties are not at liberty to disclose what they discussed. All we know is that they mediated it, this was the agreement they reached, and this was the terms that they intended to use. any interpretation of that should have been based on a motion to enforce the agreement and evidence that there was, in fact, a breach of that agreement. And that's really the sort of the crux of the problem here, is that there was no such pleading before the court.
Well, of course, we know that you can't rely upon what the title of the pleading is. You've got to go with the content of the pleading. And you're saying that, you know, it wasn't attached to this, so I haven't seen the pleading itself, but you're mm-hmm. saying the pleading did not put your client on notice that they were trying to seek to enforce the mediated settlement.
That's correct. What the motion to dismiss sought to do was to have the court enter an order based on the mediated settlement agreement. But the language in the actual order did not come from the mediated settlement agreement. It came from this purported proposed settlement document that was never submitted to the court. The court had never seen this particular document. I mean, there may have been all kinds of reasons that it was shouldn't have been signed or that he wasn't required to sign it. But the motion simply said this language is customary and therefore the Abdul-Wahab was required to sign the order. But there's no authority presented for the language being customary, and as you mentioned, it would be subject to interpretation. And if that were necessary, again, back to the notice and pleading requirement, that's what the court's going to undertake to do, is to interpret the intent underlying a mediated settlement agreement that's in dispute. It is true that Before I go any farther, I mean, I want to back up a little bit and give just some background leading up to the judgment. The case was a breach of contract that the appellee filed against the appellant in relation to a lease agreement between the parties. And the appellant also filed various counterclaims against the appellee, which were subsequently dismissed on summary judgment in September 2009. And it was on October 23rd, 2009, that the parties then mediated the last remaining claim, which was Sam's claim for unpaid rent by Abdul-Wahab. Agreement that they reached at mediation was memorialized in the document that released and discharged any and all claims of any kind, asserted or unasserted, known or unknown, that were or could have been joined in the referenced litigation between these parties. That mediation settlement agreement was filed on October 26, 2009. That was the first of three times that it was filed. And as part of the agreement, Sam's was to draft formal settlement documents. And Sam's did submit a draft to Abdul-Wahab, but he never signed it, and that document was never provided, like I said, to the trial court and never made part of the record. And it's undisputed that the appellant refused to sign that formal document because he didn't agree that it accurately reflected the party's mediated agreement. Specifically, Abdul-Wahab never agreed to release claims against any third parties, and including potential agents, and particularly never agreed to a blanket release of any and all real estate brokers who might or might not even be potential agents, depending on the specific facts and circumstances. Then in February 2010, the court set the case on its for a dismissal hearing on its dismissal docket, and apparently Sam's made an appearance at that hearing, but Abdul-Wahab did not appear. There's nothing in the record indicating why, but for some reason the trial court didn't dismiss the case at that time, and then they reset the case on its dismissal docket for May 6th. And just before that hearing on April 26th, the appellant filed the mediated settlement agreement again with the court, but the court still didn't dismiss the case based on that agreement. And again, there's nothing in the record showing why. And it was then on May 28th that Sam's did file their motion to dismiss all claims, asserted and unasserted. And as I said earlier, Sam's notified the court that Abdul-Wahab was not in agreement with the motion, both in the body of the motion and in the certificate of conference certifying that the motion was opposed. On June 7th, then, the court granted the motion to dismiss and rendered judgment releasing and discharging with prejudice any and all claims asserted or unasserted, known or unknown, that were or could have been joined in the lawsuit, which includes claims against potential agents of either plaintiff or defendant, including real estate brokers. It's appellant's position that the trial court abused its discretion by failing to render judgment in strict and literal compliance with the party's filed agreement, And the case law cited in the brief is clear that a court may not render judgment based on a mediated or Rule 11 settlement agreement absent the consent of the parties to the agreement.
So it's just...
Go ahead.
It's just the top, the first paragraph on page 2 of the order that the judge signs that you're objecting to? If that paragraph weren't in there, you would not have filed this appeal?
Well, that depends on how you interpret the one of the first paragraphs, which said that the motion is granted in its entirety, because that would still encompass that particular paragraph. So it is that additional language that releases potential agents and specifically real estate brokers that's objected to. And the problem is that the court, even if it had just rendered judgment and said in accordance with the party's agreement, res judicata would have taken care of anything that might have been filed that was included in that agreement, or the appellee could still have filed its breach of contract action, or at the end of the day, they still weren't ordered to sign the agreement. I mean, the proposed agreement, which was purportedly the breach of contract, the failure to sign the agreement. And I see my time is gone.
So. Justice McCoy, did you have a question?
When your time starts again, I want to ask you how it is that your client wants to walk away from paying rent under the terms of the settlement agreement, but wants to pursue the real estate agent when he isn't damaged.
Okay.
You can tell me about that when you come back.
All right, Mr. Payne.
Thank you, Justices. It's been a long time since I've been in front of you, Judge Gabriel, or Justice Gabriel now, so been a number of years. The issue in this case is whether Judge Curry acted so arbitrary, so capricious, that he abused his discretion when he entered the order before you, which was the order on the motion to dismiss. And consider these facts, which are all in the record before you. That order was entered after a mediated settlement agreement back in October of 2009. Both parties filed that mediated settlement agreement. Both parties. Abdulwahab, he wouldn't sign the formal settlement papers. So Judge Curry set a dismissal hearing. I appeared for that dismissal hearing. Abdulwahab's counsel did not. So he set it for another couple of months down the road. I appeared for that hearing. Abdulwahab's counsel did not. Judge Curry, as stated in the motion to dismiss I filed, because of the absence of Abdulwahab and his counsel, requested that a motion to dismiss be filed to bring the matter to a head. So we filed a motion to dismiss as directed by Judge Curry. It's a very simple motion. It's on one ground. Once you read it, you can see the summary of the motion. Defendant Hussein Abdulwahab has refused to sign a formal settlement document, as he agreed to do in the mediated settlement agreement. So this motion became necessary. That was sent to appellant's counsel by certified mail. He had proper notice. 10 days later, Judge Curry signed.
We're skirting the issue of whether or not the settlement agreement and the purported judgment are the same issue.
Well, and I'm going to get there.
I
will get to that point. So Judge Curry signs the order. It is important to note that Abdulwahab does not oppose the motion. He does not request a hearing. He does not file any evidence. He does not give any argument of any kind opposing the motion. And the primary case upon which appellant bases their argument is Berneman, which is a Supreme Court case. And there is a distinction between consent judgments and judgments enforcing settlement agreements. Two different animals altogether. Consent judgment, which is Berneman, you can't enter the order if one party does not consent. So what is the duty under Berneman? To conduct additional inquiry. That's the only duty under Berneman. Conduct additional inquiry. Did Judge Curry do that? Yes, he requested a motion be sent. It wasn't opposed. At that point, you could say that this was even a consent judgment, even though that's not our primary argument. because there was no opposition to it. The other party acquiesced to that judgment. Now, Judge...
When you sent them the motion, did you send them a copy of your proposed order as well?
Yes, ma'am. We did. They had...
Same time.
At the same time. In the letter filing the motion, they had the motion and the proposed order, which Judge Curry signed. So they were on notice of the very issue involved in this case. They had it. So did he abuse his discretion in citing that order? Of course not. A judge is required to control his document or his docket. And if one party isn't going to show up, if they're not going to be heard, if they do not preserve their error, they can't be heard to complain later. Now, there really is only one issue before the court today. There are three appellate issues that appellant briefed, but no record was ordered in this case. And under Texas Rule of Appellate Procedure 34.6C, when there is a partial reporter's record or no record, this court is limited to the issue in the notice of appeal. So we are not the failure to find findings of fact and conclusions of law really is not before this court because it's been waived. The issue on the motion to modify the judgment is not before this court because, you know, the failing to file a court reporter's record. So really we only have that one issue. Now, regarding the procedure that was involved, you know, the appellant cites you to the Davis case, which is a Houston Court of Appeals, but this court has already decided that issue to the contrary. In Nesbitt versus Warrant, a Fort Worth Court of Appeals case back in 2003, and I believe that two of the judges that sat on that panel are still on the Second Circuit, it was held that a settlement agreement that complies with Rule 11 can be enforced by the trial court after notice and hearing, exactly like we had in this case. And that the simple motion to enforce is the appropriate pleading to do that. You don't have to file a breach of contract claim. You don't have to go through the summary judgment procedure. You don't have to go through a bench or jury trial. That's what Nesbitt says.
But you filed a motion to dismiss.
I did. But just like you brought up earlier in the appellant's argument, if you misname the pleading, it's what is it in the substance of the pleading that governs. And what does our pleading say? It says we entered into a mediated settlement agreement. He refuses to comply. And now we want the court to enter an order based upon that agreement. That's what it says. And so, yeah, we've met those requirements. Not only the Fort Worth Court of Appeals follows that procedure, but the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals does too. They cited your Nesbitt opinion with approval, and they went one step further. They said that not only can a motion to enforce be the correct procedure, but you can do that orally. You can just at any time in front of the court when the other side's there, you can bring your motion to enforce the settlement agreement, and it can be heard. Now, what was important about the Twist versus McAllen case, which I was just discussing, Corpus Christi, it said that if a motion satisfies the general purpose of pleadings, which is to give the other party notice of the claim and relief sought, it is sufficient to allow the trial court to render judgment enforcing the settlement. Here, Twist was at the hearing. He argued his position. He didn't complain about lack of notice. He didn't request continuance. He didn't do anything but other argue his position, and the court enforced the settlement agreement on him based upon an oral motion.
Eventually, we're going to get around to the terms of the settlement agreement.
Yes, the terms of the settlement agreement is, without stipulation as to liability, all parties agree to completely release and discharge any and all claims of any kind, asserted or unasserted, known or unknown, that were or that could have been joined in the reference litigation between these parties. That is very global. That releases all claims that could have been joined in this litigation. And one of our arguments in our brief is there was a scheduling order in the case, which appellant signed and agreed to. It had a joinder of parties deadline. He didn't join any additional parties. So really he stuck by that. but yet he wants to go ahead and sue the real estate broker in another proceeding. But this language releases everything that could have been joined in this litigation between the parties. Case law is clear. You can have a release like that that releases everything. And, you know, just like in the Twist case, you can waive an argument. You know, if they want to complain about the interpretation of this agreement now, they should have brought those objections to the trial court at the time of the motion to dismiss. That's when they should have brought the issue.
So your position is that the phrase between the parties is not really language of limitation on the types of claims that are released?
No, I would agree with the panel. You know, you can have two different parties disagree about the interpretation of this agreement. You know, it can be read one or two different ways. Of course, I read it that it releases the real estate broker and everybody else. Judge Curry agreed with my reading. And that got into the final order, of which the other side had notice at the time that the motion was filed. Of course, they want to say, no, that doesn't release the real estate broker. That only releases you. You know, frankly, that language doesn't even mention my client in it. You know, it's not a release where it said it releases Sam's. It released everything that could have been joined in this litigation. And that includes claims against the real estate broker. And Judge Curry agreed, but I don't want to get off track on that, that, you know, we start getting into that interpretation because, you know, first, that issue's been waived. There was no complaint brought at the time that it should have been. There was, you know, for there to be error preserved for this panel to consider it, the appropriate objection had to have been made at the time of the ruling. If not, then are we going to say that if somebody can sit back, they can wait for a judge to decide, they don't even have to show up at court, you know? What about a motion to compel? Does that mean you don't have to show up at the hearing and argue your position? You can wait, see what the court does, and if you disagree, then you can bring it up later. Or you can sit through an entire trial. You can hear evidence. You don't have to make your objections. If the court rules against you, then you can bring those objections at a later time. If you don't bring your objections or your complaints known to the court at the time of the issue, you waive the issue. And I believe the Twist decision is going to tell you that. You know, in the Swab versus Swab decision, Houston Court of Appeals 2008, to preserve error for appeal, a party must bring complaint to the trial court's attention by timely request, objection, or motion. There was no timely request, objection, or motion in this case. There wasn't anything at all. There wasn't a response filed to the motion to dismiss. The motion to dismiss got signed, and here we find ourselves. It's important to note, and I think Judge McCoy may be wondering whether that specifically tracks the language, you know, the order and the settlement agreement. Well, you can waive that issue. In that Swab versus Swab decision, which I was just talking about, there was a bench trial. A party complained that, you know, the enforced settlement agreement in that case made the husband take on all tax liabilities. And that wasn't agreed to. He claimed it wasn't agreed to, but he didn't preserve his error. And so the court said, because you didn't preserve your error, you can't complain about it. You know, that's part of the deal now. Same thing here. You know, even though he wants to say that he didn't consent to it, that's part of the deal now because he didn't make his objections known. He didn't bring timely objection. He didn't complain. He didn't file a response at all, offering any competing explanation over what the terms of that agreement were. None at all. Regarding findings of fact and conclusions of law, under 34.6C, that issue isn't in before us because that wasn't in the notice of appeal, and not only is there not a partial reporter's record, there's no record, but for findings of fact and conclusions of law, that's only for issues that are tried, as that word is defined in case law. Tried is when there is an evidentiary hearing. There was no evidentiary hearing here. There was no evidence presented. And the cases are legion that says when you don't have an evidentiary hearing, like in a summary judgment, default judgment, motion dismiss even, no findings of fact are necessary. Furthermore, when you have findings of fact and conclusions of law, you don't have to if there's only one issue upon which the court decided the issue, findings of fact and conclusions of law, even in an evidentiary hearing, are unnecessary. And there was only one ground in our motion. So really, findings of fact and conclusions of law is a red herring. You know, that wasn't necessary. And I want to close. My time's about out. In the Twist versus McAllen case, it said, a motion to modify was overturned because of the same reasons that it enforced the settlement agreement. And because it enforced the settlement agreement, motion to modify wasn't necessary and really wouldn't be entertained. And with that, we don't believe that Judge Curry abused his discretion here. He is a trial judge trying to manage his docket. He scheduled a hearing, requested a motion. The other side had appropriate notice. You know, and that is the purpose of notice in our system, is to give the other side an idea of what's about to happen. Not only did they have our motion, they had the very order which the judge signed, and they didn't complain. So how can there be an abuse of discretion by Judge Curry signing that? With that, thank you. We believe Judge Curry's decision should be affirmed, and I'll rest. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Payne. Ms. Bartlett.
I need to make sure I understand your question before I undertake
it. It appears that your client wants to walk away and not pay rent, yet turn around damages and turn around and sue the real estate agent.
Well, whatever.
Getting that to pay rent.
Well, whatever causes of action might exist against a real estate broker, I don't know that necessarily has anything to do with the unpaid rent. I'm actually not familiar with the claim.
Okay.
But
good enough.
The just a couple of points. I know the Schwab case that we've heard referenced to begin with was a bench trial. This was not an evidentiary hearing. In this case, it was a motion to dismiss on submission. It was, by definition, not an evidentiary hearing. The appellee is really arguing out of both sides of his mouth. On the one side, he's saying evidence was presented. We proved to the court that we were entitled to the enforcement of this agreement. And on the other hand, arguing, well, but the appellant wasn't entitled to findings of fact or conclusions of law because there was no evidence presented. This wasn't an evidentiary hearing, so there was no purpose behind that. And that really seems like a conflicting argument. I mean, either there was evidence that was considered by the court or there was not evidence that was considered by the court that would have entitled the appellant to findings of fact and conclusions of law. Additionally, even if the appellant didn't respond in some formal way to the motion to dismiss, the appellee is not relieved of its burden to prove its claim. If it's claiming that the settlement agreement should be enforced or that the appellant has breached the terms of that agreement, there's an evidentiary burden behind that. Even one of the cases that relied on by the appellee, it's distinguishable in other ways, but in that case, the Bayway Services Incorporated versus Ameribuild, the appellant failed to respond to the motion to sign the order. The same situation is here. But the trial court went ahead and signed an order that, in response to that motion to sign order, enforcing the terms of the mediated settlement agreement that was attached to the motion to sign the order. Here we have the court not enforcing the terms of the mediated settlement agreement, but enforcing terms that the appellee says appeared in a formal document that the appellant refused to sign because he didn't agree, that it accurately reflected what he had agreed to. The court in that case went on and remanded the case to trial because it said there was insufficient evidence produced of a breach of contract. That's the same thing. Even if the appellee somehow meets that notice and pleading requirement here, there was no or insufficient evidence produced that would entitle it to have the court rule in its favor on a breach of contract or enforcement. It's not relieved of that burden. And with regard to the failure to include in the notice of appeal, Abdul Wahab didn't waive his limit or right on appeal to appeal the order denying findings of fact or the order denying the motion to modify, correct, or reform judgment. The notice of appeal properly identified the final dismissal order. The subsequent orders denying findings of fact and the motion to modify were all tied to and flowed from the dismissal order. In 2008, the Texas Supreme Court in Perry versus Cohen reiterated that disposing of appeals for harmless procedural defects is disfavored. I apologize, the case is not in the briefing, but I do have copies if the court and opposing counsel would like them. It addresses the content of the appellate notice 25.1 and Rule 38.1, which addresses the briefing requirements by including all arguments in the appellate brief. Even though the notice of appeal didn't specifically list out each and every order that was being appealed, the critical order dismissing the appellant's claims in Perry was included in the notice, as is the case here. Furthermore, the Piotrowski versus Men's case relied upon by Sams has been superseded in part by the Texas Supreme Court's decision in Michiana Easy Living Country Incorporated. Again, this one is not in the brief, but I also have copies. The court explained that a reporter's record is required only if evidence is reintroduced in open court. For non-evidentiary hearings, a reporter's record is superfluous. Michiana further held that the courts can presume that pretrial hearings are non-evidentiary, absent a contrary indication. Now, the only possible hearing at issue in this case where a court reporter was even present was the motion to modify, correct, and reform judgment. There were no court reporters anywhere else. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bartlett. Thank you, Mr. Payne. We appreciate your arguments and your briefing today. Your case is submitted.